From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the blues of organ player and record producer Ron Levy. He played the blues as a teenager with Albert King and B.B. King. When he became a record producer, some musicians gave him the blues. Later, the pugilist at rest, we talk with writer and former boxer Tom Jones about his debut book of stories, which has some critics comparing him to Raymond Carver. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews In the Line of Fire, starring Clint Eastwood and John Malkovich. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton has promised emergency federal aid to victims of the flooding in the Upper Mississippi Valley. Speaking from Tokyo, the president promised that disaster aid is on its way, although he didn't say how much money would be made available. Last week, Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy said the administration would seek an additional $850 million to add to the nearly $400 million already planned. Crop losses alone have been estimated at about $1 billion. Secretary of Defense Les Aspin is headed for Korea in meetings with President Clinton and senior Korean officials. In addition to other duties, Aspin will likely be briefing the president on options for lifting the ban against gays in the military. NPR's Martha Raddatz has a report.
The deadline for the Pentagon's report to the president is July 15th, 1 week from today. That is one day after the president returns from his overseas trip. Pentagon spokesman Captain Michael Doubleday said the gay issue is still being worked on and that Secretary Aspin is preparing options for consideration by the president. Doubleday said the secretary will present the options and his recommendations on or before the 15th, possibly in Korea or Hawaii.
I would expect that there will be discussions with the president by the secretary during the course of this trip, but the secretary may not make his final recommendation until after the trip has been completed.
Doubleday said there are a range of options being presented simply because there are a range of possibilities. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
Protesters marched in Istanbul today after the Turkish government dismissed two regional officials. The two men were charged with negligence in the deaths of 36 people in riots sparked by religious militants. The incident and its aftermath have been a test for Turkey's first female prime minister. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
More than 70,000 people marched in a funeral procession to mark the deaths in the central Anatolian town of Sivas. The incident has prompted charges that the government was slow to protect the participants at a cultural gathering. The tension began to build after Friday prayers in Sivas and lasted for more than 8 hours when a hostile crowd gathered to protest the appearance of a writer, a man who'd published the Satanic Verses, a book considered blasphemous to some Muslims. Today, the new government of Tansu Çiller dismissed the regional governor and his security chief in Sivas, while the local mayor, a member of Turkey's only religious party, was suspended. At the same time, she's called the speech that seemed to spark the violence provocative. Turkey's religious authorities have distributed a message to be read out in Turkey's mosques tomorrow, calling for reconciliation. In Istanbul, this is Deborah Amos.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 39 points to close at 3,514.4. This is NPR News. There was a sharp drop in the number of new claims for unemployment benefits last week. The Labor Department said the number of newly laid off workers at state unemployment offices was down by 12,000 in the week that ended on July 3rd. It was the second week in a row for sharp declines in the jobless statistics. Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen said today that the United States and its G7 partners are set to approve a $3 billion program for Russia to aid in the privatization of large enterprises. NPR's John Idstey reports.
The $3 billion in grants and loans will come from the G7 countries, the European Community, and the World Bank. The U.S. will provide $125 million in grants and $250 million in export loans. The goal is to support the privatization of huge Russian enterprises. Privatization of small businesses has moved rapidly in recent months, as over 60,000 have come under private ownership. But the transformation of big state-owned enterprises is moving very slowly. The U.S. believes aid in moving those companies into the private sector is necessary to make Russia's move to a market economy irreversible. The fund is smaller than President Clinton had originally suggested, but larger than had been expected only a few days ago. Russian President Boris Yeltsin arrived in Tokyo today and will have talks with the G7 leaders tomorrow. I'm John Itzty in Tokyo.
An Idaho jury has acquitted white separatist Randy Weaver and a co-defendant of the murder of a U.S. Marshal last year. Kevin Harris, a friend of Weaver's, was found not guilty of all charges related to the shootout last August. Weaver was convicted on two minor counts. The shootout took place on August 21st when federal agents prepared to arrest Weaver for failing to appear at a trial on a weapons charge. Deputy Marshal William Deegan and Weaver's 14-year-old son were killed in the gunfight. Weaver's wife was later shot and killed by a federal sniper. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Ron Levy lived out what I suspect used to be a pretty popular fantasy. When he was in high school, he went on the road, playing organ with bluesman Albert King. He left college after a week to go on the road with B.B. King. He played with B.B. King for 7 years and appeared on 9 of his albums. Levy also played with Roomful of Blues and the Fabulous Thunderbirds. Now he's a producer for Rounder Records and has worked with blues and soul artists like Champion Jack Dupree, Charles Brown, and Ann Peebles. Levy has a new recording of his own called B3 Blues and Grooves. It features him on the Hammond B3 organ, the instrument associated with skating rinks and with the sounds of such jazz and soul musicians as Jimmy Smith, Jimmy McGriff, and Booker T. Jones. Here's Levy's version of Summertime. Ron Levy, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you very much, Terry. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's a wonderful summertime day today.
Now, there's an interesting story behind this session. This recording session was not initially meant to be for your record.
Well, actually, it wasn't meant to be a record at all. How it started was a couple of years ago at the Grammys, Charles Brown and I had an album that was nominated called All My Life, which was the first record we did on Bullseye Blues, and it featured Dr. John and Ruth Brown and Charles's band. And, you know, it was Charles' big comeback record, and he got a lot of attention from it and subsequently went on tour with Bonnie Raitt. And so the day after the Grammys, which we lost, by the way, to B.B. King, and Albert Collins lost to Buddy Guy. Okay, if there's such thing as a loser and this type of thing. Now, Charles said that he was just honored to be there, and we all both had tuxedos, and we were there at Radio City Music Hall, and when the announcer said, and the winner is B, and by the time he could say B.B. King, before he even got the second B out, Charles had already stood up and put his overcoat on and said, come on, Ron, let's go. And that was the last I saw Charles for about 3 or 4 days. And then the next day at 1 o'clock, we had a recording session and he was nowhere to be found. And I had already paid Albert for showing up. I had paid the studio and got the other musicians and all this, had contracts. So we just started playing. And we just wrote two songs on the spot and just had some fun. And that was the beginning of B3 Blues and Grooves.
Did you ever find out why Charles Brown didn't make it for the date?
He was upset that, we lost and we were nominated, and he wanted the full dozen roses, and we only got one. So he was upset. So I guess he went to the track or did whatever he does whenever he's upset.
Okay. Well, let's talk about your instrument, the Hammond B3. What can the B3 do that's different from what other organs can do?
Well, I guess the mechanical whole aspect of the Hammond B3 is just it was patented by Mr. Hammond of Hammond Castle up in Gloucester, and it's just a special thing. He's got tone wheels. You've got the Leslie speaker. And it's just got the harmonic drawbars. It's got
wait. None of us know what you're talking about. So let's back up.
Well, to be honest with you, I don't know either. But I just know it sounds good, and I love playing it, and it's just sounds good. But the other organs just don't sound like it.
When you first sat down at one of these organs, was it kind of overwhelming because you could change the sound in so many ways?
Well, first of all, my feet didn't touch the bottom.
How old were you?
I was about 13 or 14 years old. It's just a fascinating instrument. And I actually started on those little combo, Farfisa combo compacts and Vox Continentals. Remember how the Dave Clark 5 used to have one of those?
Absolutely. Those little organs that stand up, yeah.
And they had those real cool chrome legs that went around with mm-hmm. You could either stand up or sit down. You know, it was really innovative at the time. It's kind of funny now, but the Hammond B3 was just a big wooden thing. It's kind of like a 56 Cadillac, It's just classic, It's just made in the USA. And it weighs a ton, too, Terry. I mean, when I first started playing it, I could always get my friends to help me, carry it upstairs to go to these gigs. And by the end of the night, I was like the Maytag repairman, very lonely. Nobody wanted to be with me because they knew they'd have to help me to carry this thing back down at the end of the night. They weighed 400 pounds. The speaker weighs about 200.
Are organs a lot more expensive than pianos? I mean, I'm wondering, a lot of parents, if they can afford it, are really happy to buy their kid a piano, a nice instrument you can play classical music on it, and it's nice to have a piano in the living room. I don't think a whole lot of parents are anxious to buy their kids B3s and put it
no,
in the living
not.
Room.
Not at all. And the thing is, they're a lot louder than a piano too, so a lot of parents, go against that too. But actually, they don't make B3s anymore, and they haven't for about 18, 20 years now. The company went out of business, and pretty much a lot of these Japanese, such as Korg and Yamaha and Roland and all these, and here in Waltham, Kurzweil, it's all these synthesizers, and they try and get organ samples and put it in, but it's a lot more economical to get one of those at this point, I would imagine. They're a lot more portable, and they're very cheap at this point.
Does your instrument have an interesting history behind it?
I had one B3 that I took out and wrote. My first one that I bought actually had the best and most intriguing history. I think you might agree. And that is, I borrowed, $1,600 from my father when I was 15. And I worked with him during the summers and after school, and I raked leaves and shoveled snow and took out trash from my neighborhood and all this kind of stuff to earn money and to pay him back. And I took this organ out with me on my first job that I ever had. I was 17 years old. I was going to Brookline High School, and I joined up with Albert King, the great blues guitarist. And he became my legal guardian at that time, because my parents, being from a nice Jewish boy from a middle-class family in Brookline, Massachusetts, they didn't want to see me just go out with anybody that wouldn't take responsibility. And what I used to do is just go out on weekends and play like Thursday through Sunday with Albert. But anyway, we were out in San Francisco playing at the Fillmore West. And we had this big jam session with Santana and all these people, Mike Bloomfield and all these people like that. And we came back after the gig, and we were staying at this little motel that had like two floors and had these beams that came down to support the second-story floor, which had like a porch, you know, walkway on it. And so we had my organ in the U-Haul trailer. We had it chained to the post. And we woke up the next morning, and the post, there was a big hole in the post, and there was no trailer. And so Albert and all of his clothes, my B3, my beloved B3, my first one, and was gone, and thought never to have find again, all right? 3 years later, Albert calls me. By this time, I'm in B.B. King's band, traveling all over the place, and Albert calls me up and says, tells me that they found my organ, and it was in a warehouse full of stolen merchandise in San Francisco, and there was a big fire there, so half of my organ was charred.
Oh.
It looked, you know, it was really horrible. So that's about the most colorful story. Ever since then, I don't let any of my organs go out of my house.
Organ player and record producer Ron Levy is my guest. He has a new album called B3 Blues and Grooves. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Organ player Ron Levy is my guest. Let's listen to something from his new album, B3 Blues and Grooves. This is Prayin' the Blues. The kind of sound that you're getting is, I think of it as a very black form, that kind of organ sound. And it's also a sound that's died out, I guess, in part because the B3 organ isn't made anymore, but it's a kind of playing that's more or less died out. How did you get interested in that sound?
Well, I'd have to say, I guess from the time I was about 13 years old, I saw Ray Charles. I had heard the music before. Growing up in Boston and listening to WILD, they used to have a lot of jazz shows, and they used to have a lot of blues shows, and I just like that music. I don't know why. It just always seemed to touch a chord in me and, you know, get a genuine response. It wasn't like pop music or just, you know, pap music or whatever. It was something that was really played from the soul, and, you know, being Jewish, in my synagogue, you know, we don't play instruments, and everybody only sings, or they, you know, what they call daven, and just pray. And, you know, when I first heard, like, of Jimmy Smith and, you know, Richard Groove Holmes, you know, the only other organ I had ever heard was, like, what you'd hear, like, in Lawrence Welk or at a roller skating, you know, ice skating place, or, you know, soap operas on television. That's the only kind of organ I heard. So it's kind of at the time, I guess it was an unusual instrument to like, Jimmy Smith just really killed me, and I'd hear Ray Charles play the organ, or Count Basie, and, you know, these were my influences when I was young.
What was it like for you as a young man to be playing a very black identified music and then going on the road with a really well-known African-American performers?
Well, you know, working with Albert and Bebe, you know, the best part really was like living with those guys for about 8 or 9 years and just being with them in a day in and day out, and just at the, you know, late 60s and the early 70s, you know, from being sort of from like a kind of a liberal political background, you know, my family and all my friends believed in the civil rights movement and all this, but it was sort of from a distance. You know, it was more like reading things and not necessarily, you know, being right in it. Whereas, you know, traveling with BB and we'd go to certain hotels and people would just look at us weird. And, you know, the first couple of years we just stayed mainly in black hotels and in the black side of town, which that's what it was called in those days. I don't know if they call it the Afro-American side of town now. But the thing is, you know, it was just it was a really great time. And, you know, I really miss a lot of the fellas that were in the band. They're passed away now, and that's why I dedicated, you know, some of the songs to my on my album, you know, to them.
What would you do after hours with the band?
What would we do after hours?
Yeah.
That's too personal. Well, we would, yeah, well, actually, no, I'm just kidding. But, you know, most, well, I was young and single at the time. We'd look for girls, and we'd try and get drunk a little bit and play music and, you know, just have a good time and just really live the life. You know, we really had a although we weren't making any money, you know, to speak of, but, you know, we did have a lot of fun. We traveled all over the world, and when I was with B.B. King's band, I mean, we could be on the show with anybody, and I think everybody in the band had the pride that, you know, we could just, like, really, you know, win any battle of the bands. That, you know, we were, you know, any band that we played with, we felt that we could hold our own and you know, steal the audience, steal the show from them. You know, whether it was the Rolling Stones or the Allman Brothers to Duke Ellington and Ray Charles to Tina Turner to anybody. You know, we didn't care. When it came time and time to hit that bandstand and play Every Day I Have the Blues, and then BB would come in with I've Been Downhearted, Baby, and do The Thrill Is Gone. I mean, we just, you know, we just played blues straight from our heart and just played that music, you know, really together as a team. We really felt that we were like a championship team.
You said that you performed with the Rolling Stones. I think they were on one of the early tours that you went on with B.B. King.
That's right. Yeah, we did. Actually, the first time we played at Madison Square Garden, there were 10 of us all wearing blue suits, right, with white turtleneck sweaters, and they wouldn't let us into Madison Square Garden because we didn't have any identification. You know, we just had our names. We said, well, who's B.B. King? And we said, well, we're just his band. We try to come in. We have to be there before for soundcheck, and they wouldn't let us in. So it was kind of ironic.
So how'd you get in?
Well, finally, I just went and talked to him. I said, look, I said, I want you to just like, if you shine your flashlight in the car with no disrespect, do you notice that all 10 of us are wearing the same exact uniforms? We're not ushers here at Madison Square Garden, because you are, would be wearing one of your uniforms. I said, we're from the band that's opening, you know, up. And so eventually we got a few walkie-talkies, conversations, and then, you know, after about 20 minutes, half an hour, we finally got in.
Well, they wouldn't have challenged one of the Rolling Stones, would they?
We never saw them. We never saw them. They would have, like, a 100-foot-long table full of turkeys and roast beefs, and it looked like a scene from Caligula, and we'd have like a little card table with like you know, lunch and meat and cheese and a few slices of rye. You know, that was about it.
Oh, so how did you go from being a musician on the road to being a record producer, which you do now?
Well, I was off the road and I was kind of hanging around New Orleans, and I was doing a lot of session work, and I had some friends down there, and I talked to the Rounder people and tried to lobby and get some, you know, money to record some of the Mardi Gras Indians and some of the brass bands down there and some of the local jazz and blues people, and I just loved it.
Do you have any stories about tracking down a musician who you've always loved and who you lost track of to get them to record?
Well, I'll tell you another funny story about Charles Brown. If you, we just finished doing his album about a month ago, and it was time. We were going to do an interview with him on the BET network. We had this lovely lady come down from Washington, and we were also going to try and take Charles's album cover photos for the session. So I, you know, he had played at Tipitina's the night before, and I said, "Charles, I'll see you at 12 tomorrow at the hotel." So I went to the hotel about 11:30. No Charles. So I'm, you know, I figured, well, he must have just gone out. He'll be back at 12. So it got to be about 12:10, 12:15, 12:20, and we had to be at the photographer's by like 1:30. Or 1 o'clock, I guess. So I started knocking on the band's door, different members of the band who, you know, we've done like 3 albums with, so we're all old buddies by now. No, everybody goes, "God only knows where Charles is now," right? So here I go again with Charles, not being able to find him. And so finally they I've woken all them up. They decided they're going to go out to get something to eat. Now I'm hungry, but I can't go anywhere because I have to wait for Charles. So now I'm all by myself, and I've had about my 4th cup of coffee, and I'm just shaking like crazy. And so finally, it just dawns on me. I kind of said, "What would Rockford do, you know, in a situation like this, or somebody like that?" So I went to the front desk, and I said, "Listen, my name is Ron." There was a real cute little lady there, so I was kind of in my Paul Drake Rockford thing. I figured I'd put in a little charm and get her to open the file. And so, you know, I told her, I said, "Look, you know, I paid for these rooms. These people are working, you know, with me this week, and their rooms are on my credit card. Could I look at the phone, tabulations for today, especially, you know, on Charles's room?" So she shows it to me, and I see this telephone number there. So I said, "Great." I said, "Can I use your phone for a minute?" So I call the number. Who answers the phone but Fats Domino? Right? And it was like, just blew my mind. I didn't know whose number this was, but all I knew is like, I said, "Man, this is Fats Domino I'm talking to." I said, "I don't know if it really is or not, but, you know," so I just say, "Yeah, hello, this is Ron Levy. Is Charles Brown there?" He goes, hey, Charles," only in a Fats Domino voice. "Come over here, the phone," you know. So Charles comes up, and that's how I tracked down Charles that time. So,
did this lead to a recording contract with Fats Domino, too?
No, geez, I wish. Let's get that together, Terry. That would be fantastic.
Really. Ron Levy, it's been a lot of fun talking with you. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much, and God bless everybody, and keep listening and loving those blues.
Ron Levy's new album is called B3 Blues and Grooves. It's on the Bullseye Blues label, which is part of Rounder Records. Well, since our interview began and ended with stories about Charles Brown not showing up, let's listen to a recording that Ron Levy produced by Charles Brown. Charles Brown showed up for this one. It's called Someone to Love.
I'm trying hard to find someone to love to ease my mind. Seems I have a world of trouble on my mind. This heavy load burdens me. I'm gonna lay it down so I can be free.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, some hard luck stories from former boxer, copywriter, and janitor Tom Jones. His debut book of stories, The Pugilist at Rest, has been praised for its gritty yet refined prose. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews In the Line of Fire, starring Clint Eastwood as a burnt-out Secret Service veteran. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Tokyo, President Clinton took a break today from dealing with foreign policy matters to deliver a radio address on the current flooding in the Middle West. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from Tokyo.
Even before he left for Tokyo, President Clinton took care to communicate that though he was flying halfway around the globe for high-level discussions with foreign leaders, he had not lost touch with domestic problems back in the U.S. Tonight he delivered a radio address from Tokyo to victims of the flooding.
As the waters continue to rise, I'm keeping in touch through Vice President Gore and federal officials in Washington. My direction to them is simple, urgent, and clear. All federal agencies delivering services to you must coordinate their actions. Teamwork is the order of the day.
The president said he'd asked his budget director, Leon Panetta, to prepare legislation that will provide emergency funding for disaster relief for the region. In Tokyo, I'm Mara Liasson.
6,000 to 7,000 people are now being told to leave their homes in St. Charles County, Missouri. Late this afternoon, officials of the city and the county ordered an evacuation of all areas along the floodplain. In St. Louis, NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
People living in 175 to 200 square miles, a third of St. Charles County, are being evacuated. Disaster officials fear the water on the Missouri, already more than 11 feet above flood stage, will further break down earthen levees that are already spilling over in several places. St. Charles is located between two flooding rivers, the Missouri and the Mississippi. The city and county have run out of sandbags, and projections for the crest of the rivers continue to rise. Storms in the St. Louis area and north have made the crest predictions too questionable for emergency management officials, who say people living in 3,400 homes must get out. The latest prediction is that the Mississippi River will crest in St. Louis, just south of St. Charles, at 15 feet above flood stage next week. I'm Kathy Lohr in St. Louis.
In New York City, UN officials said today that seals will be placed on missile testing equipment at two sites in Iraq, where video cameras have been banned. The move is apparently an interim compromise between Iraq and UN officials. The equipment cannot be used unless the seals are broken. One top UN official said that placing the seals is an interim measure until a dispute over cameras can be resolved. The two sites are both located about 40 miles from the capital of Iraq. Under Persian Gulf War agreement, Iraq is banned from developing and testing missiles with a range greater than 90 miles, but may develop and produce shorter-range missiles. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 39 points to close at 3,514.42 on volume of 283,130,000 shares. Trading again today was heavy. This is NPR News. Some 300 U.S. Marines are now in northern Somalia, but military officials say the landing is not connected to recent violence in the capital of Somalia. In the capital itself, six Somalis working on the UN Peacekeeping Forces newspaper have been killed. Officials believe the gunmen involved were supporters of fugitive clan leader General Adid. According to UN diplomat Admiral Jonathan Howe, the 300 U.S. Marines are in a northeastern port city to help rebuild buildings there, clinics, and schools, and in order to train local police. A jury has acquitted two white separatists in the slaying of a federal marshal during a shootout last August in Idaho. Jill Hoyt of member station KBSU reports from Boise.
The jury acquitted Randy Weaver and Kevin Harris of slaying Deputy U.S. Marshal William Deegan during an 11-day siege of Weaver's mountaintop cabin that left two others dead. Weaver's son was shot in the back by a federal agent. His wife was shot in the head by a federal sharpshooter while holding her 10-month-old child. During the trial, the defense presented no witnesses, claiming prosecutors failed to prove their case. The jury of eight women and four men listened to testimony for 40 days and spent 170 hours deliberating before deciding to acquit the two men. Weaver was convicted of two minor offenses, including failure to appear in court. He faces a maximum of 15 years in prison and a $500,000 fine. For National Public Radio, I'm Jill Hoyd in Boise, Idaho.
Financial ministers of the Group of Seven have warned of the dangers of long-term unemployment. In a study released today in Tokyo, the G7 called for changes in training, education, and health care as means of fighting high unemployment around the world. Before the summit meeting, President Clinton invited G7 labor officials to a jobs conference this fall. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Boxing and war are the main subjects of Tom Jones' first book of short stories. It's been getting rave reviews. Tom McGuane in the New York Times wrote, "Writers as good as Tom Jones appear but rarely." In Time magazine, his book was praised as a sheaf of extraordinary short stories about scarred, damaged men on the far side of violence. Jones started publishing only recently, but he's not a young writer. He's 48. When he started writing years ago, no one would publish him, so he gave up until recently. In the interim, he made a living as a janitor and ad copywriter. Like some of the characters in his stories, Jones was a Marine. When he was in the Marines, he was a boxer. He gave up boxing at about the time he developed epilepsy. That period of his life is the basis of this story, The Black Lights.
I was sent to Pendleton's neuropsych facility, that bleak, austere nut house, some weeks after defending my title as the 1st Marine Division middleweight champ in a boxing smoker at Camp Las Pulgas. I lost on a KO. My injuries resulted in a shocking loss of weight, headaches, double vision, and strange, otherworldly spells. EEG readings taken at the hospital indicated that I had a lesion on my left temporal lobe from a punch to the temple that had put me out cold for over an hour. I was a boxer with over 150 fights, and I had taken a lot of shots, but this last punch was the hardest I had ever received and the first punch ever to put me down. I had seen stars before from big punches. I had seen pinwheels. But after that shot to the temple, I saw the worst things you ever see in boxing. I saw the black lights.
Tom, what are the black lights?
The black lights, black lights are a common term in boxing, and people report having seen them many times after they've suffered a knockout. And I saw them just once, and it was sort of like getting swept up in this black vortex of hell, where everything just, it seemed to me that I was dead and in hell and in the grasp of the devil. It was a hopeless, horrible feeling, and I can't even tell you how long it lasted. It was probably only a couple of seconds, because I wasn't really even down on the canvas. I was, you know, on my feet and then awake again and boxing, you know.
Where had the blow landed?
On my left temple.
Were you out unconscious after that?
No, just for a few seconds. And that's another common thing. A lot of times you'll get tagged pretty good, and you'll miss a second, but you're still on your feet and you're still doing things. Or I've heard other fighters say, well, yeah, I don't remember anything after the second round, and they'll have won a fight in five rounds or something. It's a concussion, who knows?
Did you stay in the fight after you saw the black lights?
Yeah. It's too bad I did, but I did.
Now, is that the blow that you think was responsible for the epilepsy that you later got?
Well, I think after that time, I never really, the fear of God was in me after that, and I never really wanted to get in beyond sparring, which I still like to do, but, you always will as a boxer find somebody that's going to be so much better than you are, and then you just one loss is usually all it takes, and you're frightened to do it anymore because you've taken a beating, and it just sort of finishes you. Boxers only lose a couple of fights if they can stand to do that. It's a terrible kind of annihilation that occurs when you lose. It's a mental and physical thing both, and I guess it's sort of like playing some horrible, chess tournament and losing. You're annihilated when you lose, and so you never really feel quite the same when you go in again. You remember that pain, and it comes back, and you don't want to have it again.
There's a character in one of your stories who gives this advice that boxing is the science of controlling fear. Did you look at it that way when you boxed?
Yes, it's very much a science of controlling fear because you're terrified. The other guy is always approximately the same size, but he looks twice as big as you do. Your imagination does funny things to you. The night before you fight, you can't sleep. You go in the ring, and then it's a common saying. I think Customato said it that. Fear is like fire, and if you can control it, it'll warm your house. But if it's out of control, it'll burn your house down. And so the fear keeps you in a defensive, keeps you very sharp. I mean, you get very very concentrated when somebody is out trying to do serious harm to you.
What about pain? You have to take a lot of pain when you're in the ring. How much?
Yes,
of that? Yeah, go ahead.
I'm not a person who likes pain. If I've got a hangnail, everybody in the world will know it. But the when you're all psyched up in your boxing, there's so much adrenaline happening that you really don't feel pain. And then the next day, if you have an injury, it's that syndrome where it's a badge of honor, and it still doesn't really hurt that much. So that I never really remember too many times being hurt, some bloody noses and sore hands. I had sore hands a lot, but I think maybe the worst thing is a good shot to the liver. That'll hurt no matter what.
Were you boxing in the Marines?
Yes, I did.
Did you do well?
Well, that's about the time that I started having the epilepsy problems, and I didn't do very well. No, I got really hurt, and I had a form of epilepsy that was didn't manifest itself in seizures. I sort of had these blackouts, much like the ones I describe in A White Horse, where I would just lose bits of time and not know quite exactly what happened. And when I got out of the service, I went to a neurologist and found out that it was epilepsy. But in the beginning, it seemed like a kind of a psychiatric condition.
Were you on the psychiatric ward at the
Naval
Hospital?
That's in fact where I got the story Black Lights. I was in there for about 3 weeks, and they were thinking I was sort of loony rather than brain damaged.
In that story, The Black Lights, the character says the humiliation of epilepsy had unmanned me. Did you feel unmanned by epilepsy?
Of course. Of course I do. It's a terrible thing. And I've had luck with it, though, because I had a remission that lasted almost 10 years. And then it returned in about 5 or 6 years ago in a form where I have these jerks that I take medicine for, and it controls them almost entirely. So it came back in a very mild way, and I'm glad I never got into too much of the grand mal seizures, because the people that live with those, their whole lives are just governed by that. You never know when it's going to happen. And from what I've read of Dostoevsky's epilepsy, I know that it just kept getting worse and worse as his life went on, and it just turns your life into hell.
Did it make you more introspective?
Yes, yeah, almost like another person came into being because of, I think, as I mentioned in the story, I've read medical accounts where it causes a kind of a personality syndrome. And one of the curious things about it is it makes you obsessed with religion and philosophy, something that I was not obsessed with. And they have a thing called hypergraphia, where you're compelled to write. And those things were true of Dostoevsky, and I love to write.
So,
but it's funny being that you could get typed like that. I think most people with the syndrome have a very tough time because it causes depression and mood swings.
My guest is Tom Jones. His new collection of short stories is called The Pugilist at Rest. We're after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Jones, author of the new collection of short stories, The Pugilist at Rest. So were you discharged from the Marines because of the epilepsy?
Well, I got a medical discharge, and I think it was more, the diagnosis wasn't really established at that point, not until I got out and had an electroencephalogram and whatnot.
Do you think that your medical problem saved your life in a way?
Because, yes, I do. Yeah. That's why what I say about fate, because, as I said, most of the guys in my outfit were killed, and my best friend was killed. And
in Vietnam?
Yes. And so I think, well, why wasn't I? At the time, I wanted to go very much. I didn't want to leave the Marines, and I was a young guy, and I thought it would be fun to go over there. I mean, that's about how much I knew. I was not a very, very much of a thinker. I was just a regular, dumb guy from a factory town, and my friends went, and then I remember when I heard that my best friend was killed, I got a letter from his girl. She was in Paris studying at the Sorbonne. And eventually we became married 25 years ago.
It's interesting that you married your best friend's girlfriend.
Yes, very much. And that's what I mean when I say I believe in fate. It sounds kind of corny, but some strange things happened in my life. And when you look back, you think, you know, this happened and that happened, and now I'm here at this place. And I wonder why. You know, why exactly I'm here.
Was everyone in your unit killed in one battle, or did it happen over the course of their tours of duty?
Well, my friend Rolf was killed. I think he was due to come home, and somehow a bunch of Marines got pinned down on a hill, and they were all killed over a two-week period because they couldn't get in. I talked to his brother, who knew more about it, and there just wasn't anything they could do to get the guys out. And he was, I know he had a job all lined up. He was ready to come home, and he just couldn't get out. It was one of those things.
So several of them died in the same battle?
Yes, they all did, yes.
They all died in the same battle?
Yes.
How did you get the word about that, and what were your first thoughts?
Well, It's just a terrible thing, and it's hard to really. A lot of times I think about it, and I just try to imagine it, and it's hard to do. It's really hard to do. So, I remember my wife was saying during the Persian Gulf War, when I was watching it on television, that it was Rolf's birthday, and I was watching them explain how the 1st Marine Division was going to go through the Republican Guard. And I remember when I was 19, how pumped up I was, and thought, you know, that sounds like a, you know, like a big fun game thing to do. And now I'm watching it, I'm in my 40s, and I'm thinking, hey, that's going to be like Gallipoli, and those guys are going to be killed. I thought it was terrible. So his birthday and the war triggered me to write about Vietnam, and even though I hadn't been there, and so many other writers have written so wonderfully about the war, I just didn't think I had any right or was in their league in any way.
How did you write about a war that you didn't fight in? How did you imagine what Vietnam was like and what combat was like?
I'd been in the Marines and had been through the training, and I knew the weapons, and I heard the stories from the other Marines that came back, and I just listened. I was very curious about it, and I'd read much about the war. I read Michael Hare, and I loved his work, and I love Robert Stone's work and Tim O'Brien's work and Wallace Terry, and there were so many of them you can hardly say. But I think the definitive short story on that war was The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien. And I remember the first time I read it, I thought, well, that's such an awesome story. There's just no way you can write a story about it after that story's been written. But I read it a few more times, and I thought, well, I'll write my own story anyhow. I write it for Rolf, and I wrote it from my heart because I love this guy, and that's how I think that's why it was a good story.
You said in another interview that you read a lot of medical journals.
Yes.
Did you develop that habit after you developed epilepsy,
or is it just? Well, yes. Yes. I'm kind of a hypochondriac too, so I've always enjoyed reading it.
Doesn't it make it worse to read medical journals if you're a hypochondriac?
Oh, it makes things much worse, yes. You can't help yourself sometimes. It's fun to read about how many things can go wrong. And we have a state library in Olympia, Washington, and it's got a great big medical section, and you can read about anything. And I just do it. I'm fascinated to do it. But whenever I have a neurological symptom, I'll get a whole bunch of stuff, and as much as I can carry, you know, out to my car and take it home. And I'll sit there in astonishment and horror and read and think, oh, God, I've got this, I've got that. When I was diagnosed as diabetic, I started looking at these terrible things that can happen to you with diabetes, and I was astonished and horrified once more. It was, and I thought, I better quit reading these. I just don't need to know that much.
Did you actually quit?
No, I'll never quit. I'll always do it.
Tom Jones, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Tom Jones' new collection of short stories is called The Pugilist at Rest. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have from the Economic Summit in Japan?
Well, we'll be hearing about the issue of aid to Russia on the part of the seven industrialized democracies that meet in these G7 summits. We'll also be hearing about a big demonstration in Turkey today against violence by Muslim fundamentalists. Last week, several people were killed when a hotel was burnt down in Turkey. Also, a special report today about suppressed or repressed memories. Is it really true that memories of often child abuse can be suppressed in childhood and then can return to a person in adult life? Or are those memories really exaggerated and fabricated by therapy? We'll be hearing about that.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The German director Wolfgang Petersen became one of the most sought-after names in Hollywood after his 1981 film Das Boot. But then he made Enemy Mine, The Never-Ending Story, and Shattered, and suddenly people weren't talking about Wolfgang Petersen anymore. Still, maybe all he needed was a dose of Clint Eastwood. Film critic Stephen Schiff went to see their collaboration in The Line of Fire.
At 62, Clint Eastwood isn't fighting his age. He's embracing it. And just as that embrace made him a better filmmaker last year in Unforgiven, it's made him a better actor here. This is the finest performance of Eastwood's career. A lot of people will protest that that's not saying much, and maybe they've got a point. Most of Eastwood's acting has been little more than squinty eyes and a soft, flat voice. And the characters he's played haven't often demanded much more than that. They've been killing machines, stolid and invulnerable, Schwarzeneggers without the comic book muscles. Well, Frank Horrigan, the Jurassic Secret Service agent Eastwood plays in the Line of Fire, is a giant step beyond the man with no name. Horrigan, the movie tells us, was there the day JFK was killed, and he's still kicking himself about it. It was the thing that ruined his life, ruined his marriage, made him crabbed and inward and bitter. Unfortunately, someone out there named McCrawley knows all this, and he likes to call Frank up during the boozy wee hours to talk about it.
McCrawley?
Why not call me Booth?
Why not Oswald?
Because Booth had flair, panache, the leap to the stage after he shot Lincoln.
Where are you?
Closer than you might imagine. It's very exciting to talk to you. I feel like I know you.
Oh, how's that?
I've read about you, seen photos. You were JFK's favorite agent, the best and the brightest. But that was a long time ago. What's kept you in the game all these years?
Why don't we get together and have a drink? We could talk about that.
Oh, I'd love to, but I think the less you know about me, the better.
Oh, why?
Because I'm planning to kill the president.
That's John Malkovich on the other end of the phone taunting Eastwood. And under Peterson's taut direction, the two of them make up the most insinuating cat-and-mouse game since Eastwood faced Andy Robinson in Dirty Harry. It's a titillating contrast of acting styles. Eastwood with his lumbering star quality, stiff and noble, the way Cooper and Gable and Wayne were stiff and noble, versus Malkovich with all his method-trained curlicues, playing an assassin who can do anything, be anywhere, change faces and voices and moods. The story itself is a string of action thriller clichés, but the filmmakers handle it all so gracefully that the clichés come to seem honorable old conventions, like the three chords of a blues song that ring all the truer when you hear them played by a master. The screenplay by Jeff McGuire is witty and terse, and Peterson directs the action scenes with a refreshingly old-fashioned concern for clarity and pace. Best of all, though, is the way he works with his star. Eastwood has always been a potentially great romantic figure, but no one has ever plumbed that potential quite the way Peterson does here, in Eastwood's flirtation with a fellow agent played by Rene Russo. When he's abashed by his feeling for her, or dazed and frightened by his encounters with Malkovich, or haunted by his memories of that November day in Dallas, Eastwood's vulnerability is enormously touching. In the Line of Fire is certainly the best movie the big studios have given us so far this summer. You can't watch it without knowing who the real last action hero is.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Sue Weinstein and Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Our intern is Devin Reif. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Next week, some of baseball's best players will gather for the All-Star Game. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Joe Morgan, one of the few second basemen to make it to the Hall of Fame. He was part of the Cincinnati Reds lineup with Johnny Bench, Tony Perez, and Pete Rose that earned the team's nickname, the Big Red Machine. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.